Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beaten Track podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another day, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with Ian, owner of Damaged Goods Records. I mean, just go and delve into the back catalogue of that label and, yeah, I mean, you know you're going to be in for a great music chat on this episode. We talk about Ian's sort of first releases of Slaughter and the Dogs, and then we talk about Ian releasing, you know, some of the first ever releases of the Manic Street Preachers, and so much more, right up to what's coming out on the label this year. It's a wonderful chat, and before we get on with that, just a few thank yous. Big thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thank you to 76 for producing this podcast. Thank you to comedy musician, podcaster, Cunt and the Gang for putting this together for us and introducing me to Ian. And if this is your first time listening to Off the Beaten Track podcast, once you get to the end of today's chat with Ian, I'll ask you to go and have a look in the back catalogue of both Damaged Goods Records and of Off the Beaten Track podcast, because there's a whole wealth of great chats available there. If you like label owners, you can hear me talking to owners of Transgressive Records. You can hear me talking to Alan McGee of Creation Records. And yeah, you can hear me talking to all manner of musicians, you know, from some musicians that we discuss on the podcast, such as Chrissy Boy and Bedders of Madness, Terry Edwards of Gallon Drunk, and you can also hear me talking to artists as diverse as Fatboy Slim, Chuck D, Melanie C, Tommy Lee of Motley Crue, through to amazing actors like Maxine Peake, Joe Hartley, Amanda Abington, Michael Smiley, and through to comedians such as James Acaster, Ed Gamble, etc., etc. Go and have a rummage. Go and have a little look through and see what you can find to tickle your fancy. If you'd like to support the podcast, this is a labour of love, this pod, and so you can support it, but you also get lots of content if you decide to support it. And the way you do that is via Patreon, which is like a, if you don't know, like a tiny little social media sort of site, and I can upload, and what I do upload is sort of 3 or 4 radio shows each week, video episodes, other unique episodes. You also get access to a back catalogue of 200 episodes on there that have never been released to the public, and that costs you something like 71p a week. And so, yeah, that all goes in the pot to help with the production and the arranging of this podcast. If you can't do that, don't worry. Just go and listen to the 250 episodes. You can do so on Spotify, Acast, iTunes, etc. We're on all the socials as well. And so one of the things you can do to help that doesn't cost a bean is to give us a like, love, share, retweet, or better still, subscribe. If you subscribe, that really helps. And yeah, and tell your pals about it. The podcast community is a very nice, tight-knit place. So yeah, give your mate a nudge that likes podcasts and tell him to go and listen to an episode of Off the Beaten Track. Okay. That's enough of the kind of the hard sell pitching in the intro. We can now get on with today's chat. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track podcast with Ian of Damaged Goods Records.
It's Off the Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Ian.
Okay, we are recording, and joining me today via the means of Zoom It is Ian of Damaged Goods. Hello.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm all right. So we've had a 15-minute chat already, just to kind of introduce ourselves, because we've never met before. But we've got a mutual friend in... is he a musician or is he a comedian? Comedy musician, cunt in the gang.
Absolutely, and, yes.
And so we've got a mutual friend who introduced us, and I'm excited to have this chat today, because Damaged Goods, the label, has been responsible for some incredible output for a very long time now, which hopefully we'll get to discuss as this podcast unfolds. Speaking of the kind of record industry, and we're recording this at the beginning of January 2021, in the thick of another level of lockdown. How have you found the last sort of 10, 11 months, Ian, as both a human being and as somebody in the music industry?
Well, it's been obviously kind of weird. My first sort of thing that happened was that I got it.
Really? Oh, really?
Yeah. I'd gone to like the genius that I was. I went to Paris to a gig on the 12th of March, which is when Paris was just about to go into lockdown. And I had thought about it and thought, well, maybe, yeah, nah, it'd be all right. It's only a gig. We're going on the train straight through, straight back the next morning. And the gig was packed. It was a proper gig. It was packed. It was a band called The Corettes, who we just signed to Damaged Goods. So we actually went over there to surprise them. We didn't tell them we were going. Me and Duncan went over there. And it was a great night, but it was a proper sweaty jumping up and down the front, even at my elderly years. I still get drunk enough to go down the front and fall around. I probably don't jump much, but I barge into people a bit and they barge me out of the way, and then I go to the back and have a beer. But yeah, so I did a bit of that, and it was all good. It was all hot, and we stayed out till 2, went to a couple of bars and had beers, you know, like normal people in normal times. And then as we came back on the 13th, I think Paris had actually gone into lockdown, but we hadn't actually looked at our phones or checked in it. And we did think it was really quiet at Gare du Nord. And it was like, oh, there's not many people about. Got coffee with no queue and everything else. And came back and obviously then started looking at the news and realised that the record shop I'd been in the night before was now closed because they'd been shut down and their lockdown started. So got back to London, thought, and by then it was all sort of starting to happen. And so we sort of... Yeah, we tried to go out as much as we could that weekend.
Yeah.
Thinking, this is good. You know, last weekend, go around all the pubs in Leytonstone, all the cafes, go and get cake, you know, buy some stuff from shops that are going to be shut next week. So we did that. And then on the Monday night, I got sort of shivers, started shivering, and bang, I was knackered. Next day, sort of wiped out for a week, and realised I had it. At that time, you couldn't get tested. So, but I did get a test in June where it said I had the antibodies. So we did actually have it. And yeah, so that was my introduction to this. So yeah, I had a complete, we'd gone into lockdown, I think about a week later. So by the time the UK went into lockdown, I was just coming out of being ill. But you still have that one day on, one day off. You get knackered one day. Next day you think, ah, that's it, I'm back. Next day, wallop again. But after a fortnight, it was fine. And then it just, like, the dawning of it all was that, you know, A, nowhere to go, can't go out. All the gigs we had planned for that month. I mean, you know, running a label, obviously, probably 4 or 5 nights a week I'm at gigs or down the pub talking sort of bobbings to various people and going to a gig as well. So, yeah, life changed very quickly. And it was, that's the first start off, it was a bit unknown because you thought, is that it? Is no one going to buy anything? Are we stopping selling? And we didn't furlough, didn't stop, because there's always stuff to do anyway. But we just thought, oh, okay, well, we'll just take it easy. We did stop shipping for a couple of weeks. And then slowly just realised that, well, mail order's carrying on. You've got, you know, Amazon and people like that carrying on. Cargo, our distributor, was still doing it. And we sort of just carried on, really. We didn't stop. I mean, as a label, it's not been anywhere near as bad as, well, it's not been bad particularly at all. But it's compared to what the bands are going through, because
sure. They're
the poor sods that are sitting at home can't actually do anything. We can still sell records. People are probably, in some cases, buying more records because they're not spending any money on anything else, sitting on their phones, watching daytime telly and going, I'll get that. And mail order just sort of kept going, you know.
All
the infrastructure was still there. Post office was still open, all the usual things. So it's been weird. It's very weird not having that contact with bands anymore, apart from like on the phone. And the fact that bands can't really get in studios. Because obviously some bands live together, little mm-hmm. two-piece bands, but a lot of bands are all over the place and they get together to go to the studio. So we've got a lot of bands that were bringing people in from America to record. Graham Day was going to record. Guitarist is in America. So he can come over. So a lot of stuff we had shelved and we had sort of ready to go and plans all stopped. Some of our artists sort of could get in the studio, and some have just spent the whole year in the studio, like Billy Childish.
Yeah.
He's knocked out at least five albums.
Wow.
Since March. yeah, it's almost getting too many now. You know, sort of like, another two. Yeah, he's nothing else to do, basically. Yeah. So it's sort of weird. From my point of view, the weird thing is just not going to the pub, really.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing I miss the most.
Yeah.
Weirdly. I miss that almost more than gigs, I think. Just the normality of, because that was always part of the, sometimes the gig was the pub and the pub was the gig.
Yeah.
Or you always go to the pub before a gig anyway, or more or less always. And it's just that, not just going down the local, you know, having a pint, even pint or two, reading Private Eye and coming home again.
Yeah.
So that's sort of weird. I work from home anyway, so it hasn't made a lot of difference in that respect. So, yeah, just basically, yeah, got our head down and sort of carried on working and sort of tidying up. We did a lot of tidying up of things we'd never got round to, all those contacts that you, all those emails saying, oh, can you let me know about this? Got a lot of stuff out of the way. And unfortunately, yeah, we're still in the same situation, you know, getting on for, as you say, 10 months later.
Yeah.
And looks like we will be, to be honest, I don't really see any gigs happening until probably September, October.
Yeah.
Because the reality is that you're not just going to, you know, even if everyone says like, oh, April, May, the infections have gone down and everything, you're still not going to really fancy being in a room with 250 people sort of crammed next to each other. You know, some people might be, but not many people will. I don't think, you know, four deep at a bar trying to push through with a score in your hand. That's, it feels quite alien. I don't know if it does to you, but it does to me. It feels kind of alien now.
As mentioned to you previously, before we press record, that obviously as someone that runs a music venue,
absolutely.
You know, I'm hyper aware that it's going to be one of the last, you know, businesses that will probably reopen and function as it used to. I can't, in all honesty, this year envisage 500-600 people jumping around in a room together, pissed. I just can't see it. I want to see it.
Yeah, I want to see it. But it does feel complete. It feels quite alien. And it's so weird to say that after such a really relatively short time.
Sure.
But it now feels quite alien to be thinking of being, you know, that close to so many people you don't know, all pushing past each other. I mean, that's, you know, you're constantly touching people, legally or illegally, but most gigs, you know. So it's, you know, but you know, that's what you do at the Lexington or somewhere like that. You know, the stairs aren't wide enough to get past without actually, like, at least rubbing elbows or whatever.
Be interesting to see how many venues come out of this, you know.
That's the worrying thing, yeah. The really worrying thing is that, you know, we are going to lose so many venues and so many promoters that just couldn't take it and couldn't. Yeah, cope with it. And understandably, it's not like everyone's got a load of money in the bank, thinking, "Oh, just in case something happens, I'll keep like 50 grand spare." You know, and some landlords have been good to promoters. Some landlords have been, you know, bad to pubs. You know, a lot of people are. Well, we all know the stories. It's hard, and you know, it'll be a different world. It'll definitely be a different, smaller world when we come back, but it will eventually come back, I'm sure, and it will give opportunities to different people to try their hand at it, you know, and may we'll lose a few, but we'll probably gain new ones.
Absolutely.
Same as shops, you know. I guess that's, you know, but it is going to be very odd for probably all this year and probably half of next year. Yeah.
Well, let's talk records. And for track one, Ian, I'm going to ask you the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please.
I would say it's The Suite with Ballroom Blitz, because there's something just amazing about that drum and Brian Connolly just introducing the band and it just kicking into the one of the greatest pop singles ever made. And I just loved it. I'd have been about 10 when that came out, and I'd been fairly obsessed by records since I was about 5. My granddad gave me a load of 7-inch singles in about 1968 that were, like, he had a load of 7-inches and he found out albums existed and he said, you might as well have them because I'm not playing them anymore because you have to keep turning them over. And thus I got about 60, 70 singles, which included things like Beatles, Stone, all your 60s hits, yeah. Really. Quite a good selection. I mean, he wasn't super cool or anything. It was Neil Sedaka in there. There was, you know, all your obvious one, Diana. Yeah. But it was just like, great. And the first thing I did was put them in alphabetical order. So it was obviously going to be a problem. And now if I could show you around here, everything is alphabetical order.
Yeah.
You've got to be able to find things. People Absolutely. Who don't have their records in alphabetical order, I don't think they're serious.
Yeah.
Because you can't find anything. And, you know, catalogue number doesn't work.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I sort of really like The Suite already. I think I liked Brian Connolly. I liked Steve Priest fucking about. I liked the whole thing with... just that the way that Top of the Pops became a place to dress up and make a fool of yourself, and you know, builders in dresses basically. So you've got all these Brummies and all these like big butch blokes all wearing basically girls' clothes, big high shoes, makeup, and trying to outdo each other. And Sweet were obviously one of the best at that, and they were getting, if you think back to sort of like the first few singles where they had hits like Papa Joe and Little Willie and stuff like that, it started to get sillier. And then by the time they got to sort of Ballroom Blitz and Blockbuster, they were, you know, they were coming on completely outrageously. And it was just something, they were visual. It was great. You know, they were visual. These are the days when records didn't have covers. You know, most singles didn't have picture covers. So you just got a bag with RCA written on it with Sweet, blah, blah, blah. So seeing bands like that on Top of the Pops. And I think that intro, it's just great. I mean, you could start any show off with it. You could start any, you know, if ever I've DJed, you know, I'll pretty much play that first. You know, it's just great. Yeah, just a brilliant start.
The Suite has been the band that I didn't expect to see come up that much on this podcast, and I've done nearly 270 episodes now, and there's something about that band that pops up in so many episodes.
Wow. Like, really?
Yep. One of the very, very first ones I've done was with Alan McGee, and he just went off on The Suite. Just how much he loves that band. And then from then on, I was like, I did not expect him to mention that. And then literally, I reckon maybe every third or fourth episode, somebody will throw a track by The Suite in there.
Wow.
And kind of echo what you've just said about being young and seeing them on Top of the Pops and seeing Brian Connolly and like just the wow factor of that.
I think it changed everyone at school the next morning, on Friday morning, you would be, did you see Top of the Pops?
Yeah.
Did you see The Suite? Did you see Slade? Did you see Gary, you know, Gary, could I say Gary Glitter?
Yeah.
But, you know, all the people were there. I mean, Sparks, another one.
Oh.
You know, first time I saw Sparks was when they, this town ain't big enough for the both of us. And, you know, the cliche thing, my dad did say that. My dad did say, why does that bloke look like Hitler? Why have they got Hitler on the piano?
Yeah.
You know, it was like, you know, they did say that. And they said, you can't, you know, all the great things, like you can't hear the words. Why are they dressed like women?
Yeah.
You know, that was partly why you liked it so much, because your parents.
100%. You know, 100%. You know, fast forward, like, you know, a few years, and my sort of early memories of Top of the Pops was sitting there, my dad going, who's she? And I'm like, and it was watching Culture Club. And, you know, and just sitting there and the school playground the next day, everyone was like, was Is that a boy or a girl? And and you look back now and you think, why were people even questioning that? Of course it's a man.
Yeah.
But at the time...
He was a good-looking man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
You know, and he did look good, you know. You were about, is it?
Yeah. And it really was a thing. And I remember, like, you know, the press furore around it, like, you know, was Boy George, you know, is he a boy or a girl? And, yeah, incredible marketing. But
he must have loved it. He must be laughing so much at that point.
Oh, just, you know, absolutely.
This is the best thing ever, you know. Just brilliant.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Well, let's stay in the early years, and for track two, the first song you remember hearing that you had an emotional reaction to.
Yeah, this was a toughie, as we were sort of saying. It was like emotion made me think of obviously crying, of being, you know, welling up. My first emotion when I heard this band was more throwing up than welling up. It was it was like a. An epiphany of bile, and there was something about them, and I really hate the fact that quite a lot of people still say, "Oh, first album was good." It's like something about the UB40. It was just
you
like,
struggled to say that.
I know, I don't normally say it. I really try my best not to say it, or the word. I'm going to say Ali Campbell as well, because that's the main protagonist is him. And it was just something. I don't know what it was. I think it was the pork pie hat. It was, I don't know. There was something about them that just really got me. And it was emotion. Yeah, it was emotion. It was hate. It was, you know, and to hate a band for no reason is terrible. But they had just something wound me up. And they then got worse as they, now obviously they're a pastiche joke of themselves, which is fantastic. But they're still there. And it's like... You know, it peaked. I mean, UB40, you know, 1 in 10. It was that. I don't know. I think it was the accent, the faux Jamaican sort of like, you know, the patois sort of, you know, patois brum, you know. I don't know. It was something about that just made me, just vomit. And that was the best emotion. That was the first emotion I could think of.
Oh, fantastic. So,
yeah.
Where was home? Where was growing up?
Born in Hackney. Then Walthamstow, then Leytonstone, sort of Bermuda Triangle of East London.
How was that growing up?
Fine. It was good. Hackney, I was only there for a while. I did move up to Essex for a while. I lived in Witham in Essex, where I went to my sort of big school, sort of senior school. So it was because basically we all just got moved out of old houses, went to a council estate in Witham. Went to a school in Witham, which at the time was quite nice because I'd gone from, you know, basically Leibridge Road, which is a very built-up sort of area, to somewhere where there was fields and peas being grown in the fields next to us and, you know, cauliflowers around the corner and stuff. But then they just plonked all these estates on it and built. It was a very much a new town built on a bit of a village. And it was good, you know, we had, bike rides, falling in lakes, you know, all the things you do when you're stupid. Get up to about 15 when we got a SS50, Honda SS50, and was driving, you know, driving that and trying to unrestrict a restricted motorbike. And I remember going down Malden Hill once and like just not being able to stop. And you got to the bottom and it was quite a sharp right. And instead of that, me and my mate, we just went straight through into the field. And I went straight through. I managed to get my head down and go straight through into the field with the bike just about and then fell off. And then my mate, actually the bike went through and he was stuck in this hedge. Sort of thing. If there was a video of it, it would be, you know, it's like Only Fools and Horses or something. You know, it's like one of them. But so it was nice. It was nice sort of, I missed the early punk years in London. But I was only when punk kicked, because punk was what sort of changed my life, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Glam rock and all that. Music changed my life, but punk rock established you could do something and you could be whatever you wanted to be and you could do anything you wanted to do, as Eddie Knott maybe once said. And it's sort of like it just became great. And we used to go to Chelmsford to gigs. We had a crappy punk that's very rude. We had a local punk band called the Pork Dukes, who were more of a joke, really. A jokey sort of punk band, and one of them used to be in Steely Ice Band, apparently. But we'd go to Chelmsford. I saw my first proper punk gig was The Real Adam and the Ants in 78. I missed that first, you know.
What venues were in Chelmsford then? Was the Wire doing anything? Was the Army and Navy doing anything?
No. It was more Chancellor Hall.
Yep.
All the main gigs were Chancellor Hall or the Odeon.
Mm-hmm.
They were the main ones. I saw the Banshees, Cure. Banshees, Cure, Spiz, I think it was, at the Odeon. Cowboys International. But the Ants was really good, supported by a band called The Lepers, who went on to be Modern English.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, they were called The Lepers when they played with the Ants. And Young Prisoners had just come out, and I still love Adam and the Ants.
Well, we'll touch on punk a bit more, because I'm sure it would have impacted you around this time. But for track three, I'm going to ask you, Ian, the song that reminds you of your time at school.
Yeah, I guess it's hard to think of a song that reminds me of school, but I do remember this one in the playground, and it was Slade with Come On, Feel the Noise. Again, Top of the Pops, it had been on there. And I just remember loads of girls going, chasing us around the playground. Not because I was particularly attractive, but I just think that's what they thought they should do, because it was like girls grab the boys.
Yeah.
Get wild, wild, wild. And I remember that, and all going, oh, get away, you know, that you know, being, what, 10, 11, and being chased around by girls at playtime. It was like, you know, now you think, oh, that would have been brilliant. And obviously not a 10 or 11. But, you know, at the time, I think that's what reminds me of school. But there is another one that reminds me of school. The very end of school, I used to be, because I was such a nerd and so into charts and music and everything else, I used to be the one with the radio at playtime, at lunch break, when the new chart came out. And I used to announce whatever, you know, punk ones had gone up in the chart. I remember when Specials went from 16 to 1 with Too Much Too Young. And just that was probably my last week or two at school, I imagine. Sort of would have been early 80s, very early 80s. I remember announcing that and everyone going crazy in the playground. Not that I was particularly popular, but I was the bloke with the radio who knew it. And then they pushed me over after that. But, it was... So there was a couple of things that really remind me of school, but...
Did you enjoy it?
No.
What did you like about school?
I didn't really like... I wasn't particularly good at anything. I wasn't great at anything. I mean, even... I was just appalling at art. I can't draw. I could design record sleeves, but I can't draw. And they wanted you to paint and draw and do things like that. Technical drawing. I like maths. That's probably maths and technical drawing is about all I liked, really. The rest of it I thought was a bit of a waste of time, and I couldn't wait to get out and get a job, really. I did O-levels, I think. I don't even know how many I got. I got told by one bloke that I got two, and then someone else said, no, I don't think you did. And I was like, I'd gone by then. I'd moved. The day I left school, I left Witham and came to stay with my aunt in London at Stamford Hill. And then my dad moved back about 6 months later and we moved into Walthamstow. But yeah, I just wanted to get to London to go to gigs and record shops and, you know, just be a punk.
Did you know, did you have any idea what you wanted to do when you was at school?
Not a clue. Nothing. No clue. Not really. I didn't really contemplate anything that you could earn or be in the music business or what jobs there were probably. I did write to EMI Records in about when I was about 14, sent them a letter saying, can I have a job when I leave school? And they really, you know, those days you got a reply and it was like, well, you can apply this way and you can do this. So I had that and I had a few other things. And I just came to London and you could just walk into a job. It was really easy to get a job if you weren't too choosy. And I just went to somewhere called the Brook Street Bureau and just went and sat down, had a really crap suit on that I'd got somewhere and sat there. And I got a job in a very posh estate agents in Westminster, opposite Westminster, opposite the House of Parliament. It was called Clutton's, and they're the estate agents to the Queen. And I was just doing microfiche. I learned how to do microfilm, microfiche. And I lasted about 3 months doing that. And then someone said, you can get a job with the MCPS, which is the Mechanical Copyright Protection Service, which is where you pay your mechanical, every time you press a record, you pay them some money, PRS, similar sort of thing. And I got a job there. And that was my tiptoe into the music sort of scene or business or whatever. They were in Berners Street in the West End, just up from Soho. And it was like, I'm working in the West End with a load of people talking about records all day. And I was working on live. And you used to have to fill in PRS forms at the end of each gig. You still technically should, but no one does. And we used to get them forms and analyse them. They didn't really have a card. They had card systems and things, obviously pretty much pre-computers. So we used to add it. But, you know, we'd be looking at forms. You'd get a big pile of forms and a lot of it would be, you know, ramshackle blues band that played down the road and played the same old songs. But then you get Judas Priest and then you get Generation X and they were signed by someone. And I never nicked any. I should have nicked some.
Yeah.
But I never nicked any. But, you know, I was going through. They're like, they're actual like band gigs and, you know, and you're analysing it. And it was really good. And especially if you knew what you do, you know, you knew about records.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people would look at something and go, you know, if you write a song called Love, then there's a good chance some idiot will put some money to it because they don't know what the most famous one is. So your best thing is to write songs exactly the same titles as the most famous songs. And by default, someone will give you some money because they don't know that it really is the Lennon McCartney one or whatever.
Yeah.
So I worked there for a year and a half and it was really good way of sort of meeting people. Not that I was thinking this is a job, this is a career. And I used to just spend my whole time around the record shops in Soho, Berwick Street Market, stalls, Hanway Street had about 6 record shops all with collector stuff. And I learned more about like collectible records and white labels, things you wouldn't know about until you got somehow connected with radio or promo and stuff. And yeah, I remember I used to spend every single penny I had either on that or arcade machines.
Well, that ties in perfectly because for track four, I'm gonna ask you the first record you remember buying.
First record I remember buying was actually me instigating being bought. Would have been it was in about 1968, 69. Was Johnny Nash "Hold Me Tight," which is a sort of bit scary, bit pop song. Not the greatest record of all time, but I just remember I heard it at Pontins on a jukebox. I remember having to be lifted up to see the record going round, and I was like, "Ah, that one! Can I have that one?" And it was, I think, I got to a point by about 6 or 7 where people started saying to me, "Do you want an Easter egg, or do you want a record voucher?" And it was like, "Oh, I'll have a record voucher," and then I could use it to sort of like get records.
Yeah,
because obviously you didn't have any money, and in them days you didn't really get pocket money. I'd be lucky if I got 10p.
Yeah.
It's not quite the same as now where you transfer some money to someone's, your child's card. It was that one, Johnny Nash, Hold Me Tight. I've still got it. It's, it's a good single, but it's definitely not one of my favourites, but that was the first one. There is a, I don't know if you want the follow-on from that, but there was the one I remember actually buying with real money, was David Bowie, Diamond Dogs.
Oh, what a record.
And the only reason I bought that was because I went at Martin's, the news agents in Witham, in the arcade, and they used to have new releases on like one of those metal racks, you know, like the old toast racks for records. Yep. And they had them all there. And I went in to get something else. There was another record in the chart. I don't know what it was, like Rubettes or something. It would have been something like that. And they didn't have it. I was with my dad, and he went, "Oh, they haven't got it, so you might as well leave it." And I was like, I'll get something else. And I went through, and there were ones that weren't in the chart. So I hadn't heard it. And I sort of saw it, and it said, and it didn't say David Bowie. It was when he went Bowie. And I remember getting it and going, "Oh, I'll have that." And he went, "Well, do you know, how's it go?" And I went, "I haven't heard it." He went, "Well, get something you've heard. You might not like it." I said, "I will like it." And he's like, "Get something you know. Get something, what's number one? And I'm like, "No, I want that one." And so I got Diamond Dog. Eventually, gritted my teeth, got Diamond Dog, got home, put Diamond Dogs on as a 10-year-old and thought, "Oh, God, that's really long."
Oh, he's no Rubettes, is he?
No. And it was, and it's quite a grown-up single. I mean, it's not really a single. It's not a pop, you know, it's not Gene Genie.
Yeah.
Really, you know, it's a great, I love it. I absolutely love the song, of course. But luckily, the B-side was Holy Holy.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, bang, straight in, Holy Holy, you know. It's like really, you know, fantastic. Proper bit of, in my mind at the time, pop music, glam rock, whatever. So I was pleased anyway. But yeah, that was it was such a great thing with my dad. It was like, yeah, him saying, "Well, get something you know," and I'm like, no, I'll have that. And he said, "That doesn't even say David Bowie." Like, well, it obviously is. It's on RCA, you know. But yeah, good conversations to have when you're 10.
I ask all guests this, and it seems a ridiculous thing to ask you, but just the importance of record shops, you know, then and now. And I mean, obviously, you own an independent record label, so I presume record shops are still a very, very important place.
They're an integral part of my business plan. Mm. But yeah, growing up, record shops were the place to be, you know, the most exciting place. Kind of scary sometimes because you felt a little bit out of your depth because obviously they knew everything. You know, the bloke behind the counter was your leader. And you would sort of go in there and sort of, yeah, you wouldn't, it'd be so much stuff that you didn't know because, you know, now things are a lot easier to find out about. We've all got phones, we can look up everything. But, you know, you go through stuff, you know, I could have gone past Velvet Underground Records and what the hell's that? Never heard of that. You know, you didn't have loads of money to buy extra things. You could only buy what you knew. It was just great places to hang out, just great places to spend hours and hours until probably sometimes even got told to sod off because you've been in there so long. Like, there are other people will come in the shop. But I remember when we had one shop in Witham, there was like, you could get your records from electrical retailers. The bloke who sold fridges Rumbelows in Witham.
Yeah.
Had a little record section. There was another electric shop down the road that had a little record section. And it was always worth going around because when they couldn't sell them, they'd stick them out for 5p or 10p. Yep. And you could pick up like whatever was in the chart 2 months ago, like really cheap, or ex-jukebox singles on the market. No middles.
Yep.
But, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, it was great for that sort of stuff. But then we had a proper record shop open in Witham called Musicrafts, which was run by a bloke who was just really relaxed. So he was obviously a bit of a dopehead, I imagine.
Yeah.
Thinking now with hindsight. But he always seemed very chilled and relaxed. But it was when sort of the punk stuff was starting to come through. He'd have all the singles. I bought Holidays in the Sun by the Pistols there, and he saved me a picture cover because that was very limited. In them days, it was very limited. I think it was 100,000. Yeah, now that would be like 100,000 would last the rest of the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, getting the picture cover was like the be all and end all. And I got one of them. But I also remember buying the the record that I named my label after, Damaged Goods by a Gang of Four. From there, the same week, I bought two singles. I bought that and the Human League, Being Boiled. They both came out on the same label, Fast Records. And
that's a good couple of purchases, right?
That's a great couple of purchases, yeah. And I didn't really know them. Yeah. Human League one I bought because I hadn't heard that. I think I'd heard Damaged Goods.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd heard Human League, but it was on the same label and the cover was brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, what a cover. I think our mutual friend may well have that cover tattooed on him.
I think he might do. It is a great single.
It's a great single. Bizarrely, that the podcast I recorded first thing this morning was with Martin Ware. I had a good chat about all that kind of era of what was going on in Sheffield.
This
morning. Yeah. It's really weird that same mutual friend that we've been speaking about, during this podcast, I was responsible for his first record purchases. And that come about, and it, like you say, electrical outlets. We had a toy shop that sold half toys and half records, and it was going under. And so I think he had a couple of bob in his hand, and I was like, right, come on, we're going there, and I'll tell you what to buy. And he bought Madness. I remember he bought...
That's not a bad start.
Was it Absolutely or Keep Moving? I think it was Madness. And,
an album?
Yeah.
An album? Yeah. Oh, right, okay. Oh, you were posh.
And they were flogging them off super cheap. Oh, okay. And, and so when did your... Just going back to, you touched on Damaged Goods then. When did your kind of, what I guess was an obsession with records and music, when did that change from... just a passion to the concept of it being a label and a business?
Everything I did was music related, sort of like as a fan, buying records, getting into the minutiae of labels, finding out, if you've got number two and three on that label, what was number one, and things like that. And I quite interested in the how records are made and things like that. And it was about 86, 87 that I thought, it'd be really good to make a record, to make one. I didn't know what I was going to make or why. I wasn't doing it as a business. It was just like, I want to make a record. Not with me on it, but I wanted to make a punk record. And it was quite a funny time, really, because it was 10 years after punk. And punk was pretty much a dirty word at that point.
Mm.
Now it's sort of seen as in its historical sort of way and everything, punk's not dead and whatever. But we'd gone through all that Oi stuff and it had got down to sort of Exploited and them sort of bands, which I wasn't that keen on. That's that sort of second wave when it went a little bit metal in some way. It went, when the Cockney Rejects and people like that started doing metal albums and it was appalling. They were shit at it. And it was like, I'm not interested in any of them bands. There was the odd, and the new wave stuff had got very poppy. Like, obviously, the Human League had become complete pop bands and Gang of Four funk band and, some of those bands. So there was stuff going on. But then there was a real good upsurge of, indie pop sort of stuff, all the C86 sort of stuff, with bands like Tallulah Gosh and BMX Bandits and that sort of thing, which I really like. So I love a pop song.
Mm-hmm.
I think underneath everything that I like is a pop song, whether it's someone screaming and shouting it, metal noise, horrible thing, still a pop song. Very rarely like anything that hasn't got a tune. And I sort of just got to a point where I thought, okay, I'd love to make a record. So how do you do it? And I didn't know. I had a vague idea that you cut a record, was cut and then it was pressed. I didn't know the ins and outs. So I sort of, there was ads in the back of papers saying, press 500 singles or 300 singles for 200 quid or whatever it was then. A lot cheaper than it is now. And it was, I just thought, oh, okay. And there was a place called Vinyl Cuts, which was in Stratford. It's long since gone. And I phoned them up and just asked about doing a record and how it would work. And he said, well, you need to get it cut. And I'd seen on records like things like Porky's Prime Cut, and things like that on the little scratchings on the run out groove. And I didn't know what Porky's Prime Cut was, but I knew that it was the person that had cut it. So I tried to find out who Porky was, and I found out he was a bloke in George Peckham who was actually still based in Shaftesbury Avenue, still doing cuts and everything else. And you could just phone up and book one in. So I thought, okay. So I'd saved up some money and I got about 500 quid. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do? So I had this sort of idea about, I didn't really know any bands that well that I was going to see. I wasn't really talking to a lot of bands, or I was going to gigs, but obviously I came from Witham to London. So I didn't have like a circle of mates when I first got here that were not coming down from Witham. And they would only come down every now and again because it's a long way to London, nearly 45 minutes. So yeah, people don't tend to like going to London. Oh, London, I went there last year. So I thought I'd like to reissue something, and I thought I'd like to reissue an old punk single. And Slaughter the Dogs was one of my favourite singles, Where Have All the Boot Boys Gone? So I thought, well, I'll write to Decca Record, totally naively. And, you know, I phoned up and he said, I got through to someone at Decca who said, can you write in and send us a letter with what you want to do? So I did this cutout. I did like all this sort of lettering, Sex Pistols-y sort of lettering, cutout letter. I want to, unfortunately, I picked Slaughter and the Dogs, Where Have All the Boot Boys Gone? So it took a bloody long time to cut all those letters out. So I think halfway down the letter, I got bored of it and typed the rest. And then I sent it on Dayglow yellow paper and sent it off to Decca with, I want to release this single. Can I license it from you or do it? You know, can I, is that okay? And this bloke, amazingly, about a fortnight later, I got a phone call at home from this bloke, and he said, right, I got your letter. It's possible. You know, what sort of licensing fee can you pay? And I was like, what does that mean? And he went, oh, don't worry. And it sort of, the conversation went a bit like that. He said, oh, have you done anything before? You know, have you got any references? I was like, no, I've done nothing before. It's my first single. And, oh, okay. It turned out that Decca was on its last legs. They're pretty much gone. Not, but I don't know if they'd gone bust, but they were being sucked into a big, the Phonogram Group, I think, or Polygram, whatever it was called then. And I think all their jobs were going. And so the bloke was very amenable and didn't care and thought it was really funny. And he lived in Chingford. I lived in Walthamstow. And we started talking. He said, oh, we've got a contract. I said, oh, okay. Do I need to sign that and read that? And he said, yeah. He said, I'll bring it around. And he said, oh, you know, what tracks do you want? And I got an extra track from a B-side from another single to make a three-track EP up. So I knew what I wanted to do with the record. I knew what I wanted it to look like. So I photocopied stuff and made a cover. And basically just, he turned up on my doorstep about 4 days later with a reel-to-reel tape and a contract about as thick as a decent-sized mid-range telephone directory. And I just went, ah. And he said, ah, don't worry, just sign it. No one's going to care. And, he gave me the tape, and that's how I licensed the first record, the Slaughter and the Dogs record. It was as easy as that.
Wow.
Which would never happen in a million years now. Yeah, that could not happen now. Yeah, so it was pure luck that I ended up with that single. I might have ended up with something else by asking around and talking to bands or something.
Yeah.
But at that point, that was all I ever wanted to do, was one single. And I went to George Peckham, saw the single being cut, met George Peckham, Porky's Prime Cut, the legend. He was a crazy man, dances around to everything, dancing to Slaughter the Dogs. So this is quite bizarre. And paid him, took my lacquers up to this place in Stratford, got there. It's like the smokiest, dirtiest, horrible place. The industrial, making records is not a pretty thing. It's a very industrial process. It's hot plastic, big tubes with steam coming out of them, smoke, you know, blokes, you know, black eyes where the gunk's going around. I mean, it's horrible. You're melting plastic.
Yeah.
I'm surprised most of them are. Yeah, most of them probably are dead, unfortunately. And I watched them do the... I went back a few days later once they... Because you have to, from a lacquer, you have to then grow a negative and a positive and get your stampers. I went back when they were doing the very first record, and dropped a dab of, it's a red vinyl single, and I did a couple where I took a little blob of blue in, which is very normal now. Everyone has multicoloured singles, and yeah. No one did that then. And so I've still got number one, which is my one with the blue dabs in, and pressed 500 singles. And I was a record label. Luckily, I changed the name a few days before, because it was going to be, originally my label was going to be called Groovy Pineapple Records, which would have been a terrible name.
I think you've done the right thing there. Damaged Goods is...
Sounds right, doesn't it? Yeah.
Definitely.
It was weird, though, because, I had this thing in my head, Groovy Pineapple, and it was like, I had the hilarious pineapple with arms and legs and sunglasses cartoon that I'd done. And, could have been one single and out. And then I think I was sitting there and I thought, Damaged Goods, because I'm reissuing old stuff, therefore Damaged Goods. It made sense. And obviously the Gang of Four single was one of my favourite singles as well. So that's how that happened. So, that started off. But it still wasn't a business. It was one single. And all I wanted to do was I took 10 to Rough Trade, traded them for some single, got some store credit, and basically did it like that until... I got contacted by a couple of blokes with another label who were quite interested in what I was doing, because they wanted to license that album, the Slaughter and the Dogs record, and they couldn't get it, and because they were quite official and it was very difficult to sometimes license stuff, and they were sort of sussed me out a little bit. They were a bit punk, old school punk rock sort of label, and once they talked to me, and I was obviously enthusiastic and knew what I was talking about, they were really helpful. And they told me about distribution, exporters, which were the life and blood of the music, UK music scene at that time, and introduced me to people. And they said, you should get the album. So I phoned the bloke at Decca and said, can I have the album as well? 2 days later, he turned up with the tapes. And an addendum to the contract was just signed and never looked at again. And,
wow.
That's how it all started. And it pure naivety, really, but just sort of worked.
Cool. There's a lot of right place at the right time there.
Yeah, pure luck. I mean, pure luck, but, you make your own luck by having a go.
Yeah.
You definitely wouldn't get that now. You couldn't phone up any of the major labels now and say, oh, yeah, I want to start a label. Can I loan that? They're like, no, you need 10 references. You need all the... It would never happen. So that was a great, lucky way to start. And it sort of went... And once I'd done the album, it sort of then became like, oh, okay, this is... It sold fairly well. And I thought, oh, okay, this is easy. Which was the next lesson. But, yeah, two years on when I started doing new bands, before the Manic Street Preachers came along, I realised that not everything sells, and you lose a lot of money every record I was making.
What was the track you done with the Manics?
Their first proper single. They did a 7-inch on their own for a studio down in Wales, and I saw them in '89 at the Horse and Groom in Great Portland Street, up above the pub. very little room, and they were brilliant. They were jumping around, all logos all over their white coats and jackets and trousers and everything, and they were just really good. You couldn't really hear nothing. They were on the floor. There was no stage in that place, but the enthusiasm was great. And I just went up to them afterwards and said, I've got a record label, I did the Slaughter and the Dogs thing and a couple of other, and James was really into that sort of old punk rock as well, and Nicky, they both knew that single, and it actually bought the Slaughter and the Dogs single. And because I said, I'll swap you one for your old single. And he went, I've got it. And I went, oh, okay. Well, I've got the album. And it was like, oh, right, okay, yeah. So, and I said, I'd love to do a record. So we got in touch with a lot of letters. It was all letters in them days, obviously. So I'd send them a letter. They'd send me one back with some things. And they were playing again in London at the Rock Garden or somewhere. And they sent me a load of flyers because the Rock Garden was pay to play.
Yeah.
So you used to have to sell tickets to get any money.
Yeah.
They just rip bands off left, right and centre, as we all know.
I got ripped off there about 4 or 5 times in my band.
Yeah.
But as a band, you thought you was playing the Rock Garden. For me, I thought I was playing Pasadena Bowl. It was like the Rock Garden. And they sent out these tickets. I can't remember what beer it was used to sponsor the tickets and all their events. But It was. Oh, I can't remember, but I remember thinking, "Oh my God, I'm playing the Rock Garden, and I've got proper tickets." You know,
this is it.
As a promoter now, I just think you're robbing bastards. Literally just fleecing bands left, right, and centre.
Yeah, you get £1 for every one you bring.
Yeah,
or something. You know.
Yeah, you got to bring a couple of coach loads up though, lads, if you want to play. Yeah. Oh yeah, no worries.
We come all the way from Wales in a van. We're sleeping in the van. We're knackered. And you've got 12 quid. Thank you very much. That should cover your petrol. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. But, that was the first band I paid for the studio and put in a studio, weirdly, in Redditch. They didn't want to do it in Wales. They wanted to do it somewhere else than the only studio someone recommended to me.
Who produced that?
Mark Tempest.
Right. Did Dave Ehringer produce the early stuff that followed that?
Yeah. Once they signed major, yeah.
Yeah. So what track did you do with them?
New Art Riot.
Right,
Four-track 12-inch.
Yeah.
New Art Riot, Strip It Down, Teenage 2020, and another track. Not that I'm cheating. Last Exit on Yesterday.
Yeah. Oh, look at that.
That was the very limited pink vinyl one.
Oh, that's nice. Who done the artwork on that?
They did.
Mm.
They sent me that picture of the European flag, and we superimposed the writing on it. And that originally was going to be a picture, but then they decided they didn't like the picture of the band. So we just did that sort of thing. But, yeah.
Lovely.
It was good, and obviously that was our first sort of successful thing, because by the time the record came out, which was June 90, they started to get antagonise the press and antagonise every other band by telling every other band that was going that they were shit.
Oh, I'll tell you what, Ian, I don't know if you've listened to it. Have you listened to Nicky Wire on Adam Buxton's podcast?
No.
It's a wonderful listen, because obviously, you know, they talk about, you know, the huge success that the Manics have had, but they play a game where Adam says a line and he's like, did you or Richie say that or did you not? And obviously, fuck me. So, what was the one about Slow Dive?
I can't remember the line, but I mean, Slow Dive were like, you know,
they
would rip the shit out of everyone. I mean, all the bands that I knew and other bands that I liked, and like Mega City 4 at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they hated the Manics. I had a bet with Jerry from Mega City 4 that the Manics would get in the top 40 before they did. And I won a tenner off him. And he was really pissed off. And because he said, why are you working with them? They're shit. I said, no, they're great. They're lovely.
It is weird, really, because they did sit kind of out of place of everything else that was going on then.
Absolutely, completely. Yeah. I mean, they were, you know, they loved punk rock, you know. In their minds, they were a punk rock band. Obviously, it sort of changed quite quickly.
But nothing else was happening like that then, was it? When you look at what was happening with that kind of what we called out, like the Grebo scene with, you know, Mega City 4 and Senseless Things and Carter and Poppies and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you'd have to like the shoegaze stuff. And then you've got these four lads wearing makeup, white denim, talking about Guns N' Roses and Public Enemy. It was
It was confusing, yeah.
And then obviously Richie does the big carving on the arm.
Yeah.
They obviously knew how to work the press from a very young age.
Yes, they were good at like the quote, the controversial stuff, and getting noticed. And I think they just had opinions, and they're really bright.
Yeah.
You know, that's the other thing. I mean, a lot, you know, people always go, "Oh, stupid." They're not. They're really bright and articulate. I mean, Richie, you know, Nicky, you know, they're all really, really bright, and. They used their knowledge and they worked out how to do it. And, the whole thing with the for real thing with Steve was horrible.
Yeah.
And Richie was in a bad place. I mean, that's not a good thing to do for anyone. I saw him do things to his arms. It's horrible.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we all know what happened in the end. But, you know, that was the real, that's the really, really sad thing with the Manics is still the whole thing with Richie.
Yeah.
Just terrible waste. And just like one, you know, absolutely awful. But no, they were astounding. They were really good. And
yeah,
the tour when they broke through, I think probably around Stay Beautiful or Motown Junk and that, yeah, where the controversial tour where, you know, gigs were, it was almost as exciting going to one of their gigs. Something would go wrong, so they wouldn't do an encore, someone would throw something.
I saw them at the Town and Country. And I'm a huge REM fan, and I'm sure it was Nicky, not Richie. Nicky said a really big quote about Michael Stipe and AIDS.
Yes,
and that one caused a lot of furor, if I remember rightly.
That did. Yes, they did. Yeah. And then there's that classic cover of the Enemy, or I think it was the Enemy. I think it was the Enemy where Richie's got HIV written on his.
That's right.
He did it in the mirror, so it says VIH.
That's right.
The reverse, but they were interesting times. But yeah, those gigs were amazing. I remember going down. I used to go around with them still, sort of for quite a long while. And I think it was the Reading After Dark. It was just really exciting, and it was electric in there because you've got people that have just gone there just to throw things at them.
Yeah,
you know, as much as people who've gone there because they liked them. And it was a real, you know, people had gone just to lob beer at them and, you know, and then they'd react. And, yeah, it was great. They were, you know, a bit like when the Sputniks broke through and they had that week of mad gigs. Like, I went to Dunstable to see the Sputniks. And it was so exciting because it was like, you know, half the crowd thinking this is the second coming.
Yeah.
And half the crowd thinking I'm going to kill them. And, always the best thing. So, you know, controversy, makes things very exciting. It's nothing, you know, more dull than going to see Slowdive, for example. You know, shoot me now.
For track five, I ask guests about the song that soundtracked their year's clubbing, and you was you dropped me a message saying you never went clubbing, and I mean, I should mention that the term clubbing does lend itself to a dirty, sweaty indie night anywhere, but.
Well, I was going to suggest Seal, but I thought that would be too much of a shit joke. But I couldn't. Sorry.
And so, no, what I was going to say was obviously you've just touched upon the electricity, you know, seeing the Manics, you know, at them early shows and stuff like that. So I imagine that somebody that was constantly looking for new and exciting music, that gigs were going on instead of clubs.
Absolutely.
And so just, them early 90s and things like that, like to pick on that kind of era whilst we were there. I just wonder, you know, what other sort of gigs you saw then that have really stuck in your mind?
Public Enemy, really early on, was a wonderful gig. This was before the Beastie Boys one, I think, the one before the Beastie Boys one.
So that was the one with LL Cool J and Eric B. McKean.
At Brixton, really exciting, and they were great, you know, properly good. And the Beastie Boys ones, you know, were even better. They were a bit more, the crowd had changed completely by then. They'd become like more mainstream, and obviously people were there to see the Beastie Boys. But those gigs were really, really, really exciting. I mean, there was no end of great gigs, you know. I think probably the first time I saw Sparks was in, because they didn't really come over because there was no demand. A lot of the records didn't come out. So I remember the first time I saw Sparks, I was almost like crying with delight and just thinking this is the most wonderful thing. And they were just so good, and they still are.
Yeah.
The weird thing is now, even now, you know, they do bring tears to my eyes. I could have maybe had that as an emotional moment, but it wasn't an early emotional moment. But Sparks had brought tears to my eyes.
I got really close to getting them on the podcast, and it kind of just fell through, and I was like desperate to get it on.
That would be wonderful.
Definitely. I did get Chuck D, so I can't complain. And
to chat to Chuck,
who, you know, around that time, 87, like Public Enemy, that, you know, that, and the Beastie Boys. I was chatting to someone the other day about it, and was saying, you know, as a 47-year-old man, I would have been like 15, 16, something like that, when them gigs were happening. And I guess that was kind of my punk.
Yeah.
The furore around the Beastie Boys, you know, we don't want them in this country, you know, blah, blah. Like, robbing VW badges off of cars and putting them around their necks. And, you know, that was as punk as it got for, you know, for me as a young lad.
Yeah. Well, that, I think that's the thing it's a really weird thing, and it's sort of like, you don't want to sound like a total old git, even though obviously I am an old git. It's that there isn't gangs now. There isn't gangs music-wise. You know, there isn't like punks and Teds and, you know, mods and New Romantics. And,
there is metalers, yeah. though.
There are metalers. Metalers are
that,
still there.
That tribe has never gone away.
No, there are old tribes, but yeah. There ain't anything new. There's nothing, there doesn't seem to be like
no,
a new...
and it's really strange. Because I have this conversation quite regularly because it is mad that back then it was, you know, your picture, you know, you wore your colours on your sleeve, you had your band t-shirt, and you found your tribe. And now I think, and I put a lot of that down to sort of streaming services of you know, how easy it is to access whatever music.
Everything's available, so you don't pick one. When I talk, I often ask, like, you know, younger people, like relatives and things, of kids and stuff, and say, what do you like? A bit of everything. And they'll say a bit of everything. And I say, I listen to the Beatles, I listen to that. Do you? Yeah, it's like, oh, right, so you don't, there's not, but there isn't, you know, there isn't, and it is the access thing, you know. It was great buying the music papers, because you'd see all your favourite bands were doing once a week. That was your info. That was all the info you had, you know, gig. Amazing, you know, that we all managed to get anywhere and meet anyone in those days, you know, without actually having a phone. You know, we all got to gigs. We all, you know, managed to beat everyone, go down the pub with people, without actually saying, I'm going to be 2 minutes late.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just outside. Yeah. It's like, don't phone me and tell me you're just outside. And it is kind of, I think that has, that is what's changed. I think there's no tribes, there's no, you know, there's, you know, we're still, you know, in my mind, I'm still a punk rocker, but it is, it seems a shame that it's not that for the kids growing up now. Haven't got that. They can still, obviously, you get the odd one that will turn into a punk rocker or a mod or whatever, but it's not that, it's not a big thing. It's not like at school where, you know, you were a punk, all you did, if you were a punk, all you did was pull your tie a bit tighter and move it over slightly and have a safety pin under your lapel, and if anyone's sending it, are you a punk? Yeah. Oh yeah. Look at that. Yeah. Oh, right. And chalked anarchy on me back once, and then everyone started bashing it off.
Running, you know, what is I guess you'd call it an alternative night spot or whatever you want to call it, but, you know, the club that I work at.
Yeah.
And working at a time I've seen these waves come through of, you know, we touched on that whole Grebo scene of, you know, the early 90s that was happening in the UK, and obviously go back a couple of years to what was happening in, you know, in Manchester, and then moving forward through to switching to Seattle and the deemed grunge through to Britpop. And there was all of these scenes that, you know, certain parts of, you know, every college, you know, they'd be like, right, this gang here, they're the indie kids, they're the rockers, they're the grungers, you know, they're the shoegaze kids over there in their cardigans. Like, and it's like, and that was my first clubbing experience, just to touch on clubbing. I went into the club that I run, and I went in there, and there was loads of people with quiffs and cardigans flancing around to the Smiths. There was people that were dressed like Robert Smith. There was loads and loads, obviously being so close to Basel, and there was loads and loads of people with these. This is like, you know, 88, 89, loads of people with sort of like quiffs and their hair shaved like Dave Garn, and it was like, and, you know, Nitzareb and all that was happening then, and it was like, there was industrial, and it was like, and I just thought, oh my God, this is mad. I've never seen anything like this. There's so many tribes within a tribe.
Like,
I'm in. I want to be in. And
I think Pink Toothbrush was where Depeche Mode played most of their early gigs, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right. Yeah. That, yeah.
Places like that.
That's right. I have a cassette. I have the first. I have a desk recording of one of those early Mode shows.
And, yeah, I've got some of those as well. Yeah.
Sounds awful.
Yeah, I mean, it's plinky-plop,
isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it doesn't sound as awful as... I mean, I'm a Depeche Mode obsessive, and it doesn't sound as awful as some of those... Depeche Mode, Live in 87 from blah, 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 on vinyl that I bought on Camden Market. Them kind of Schneid bootlegs that... I got suckered into so many of them. every single one absolute utter shit.
Of course they are. Yeah. But they're probably worth double what you paid for them.
Probably.
So you can always get your money back. But if you're a Depeche Mode obsessive, I will share my trip to Mexico in. When was the 101 tour? Was that 90 or 92?
101, 87.
Yeah, 80, was it? 87. Okay, so it must have been the year after. So 88. I was in LA and we went down to Tijuana. Friends of mine had run record shops in LA. I used to sort of go over there quite a lot. And we went down to Tijuana, got on the rickety bus into Tijuana, and we just went for a beer. You know, surprisingly a Corona. And we found this place. This woman going, Depeche Mode Disco, Depeche Mode Disco, because they were the biggest band in LA at that time. They were massive in LA. Everywhere you looked, there were posters, all the gold and black posters, you know. And it was just like, and we went in there, and they just got a load of posters on the wall of Dave Garn in different, like, you know, wiggling his ass in different ways. And we're in there, and there's like four Coronas for a dollar. And we sat in there listening to like Depeche Mode at a million decibels. This is great. I like Depeche Mode. I you know, as much as like, you know, I was supposed to be a punk rocker, I love Dave. I like Martin Gore's solo stuff, counterfeit stuff. You know, Never Turn Your Back on Mother Earth, for example.
And cheap beer.
Yeah, and cheap beer. And it was great, you know. So yeah, I actually went to a complete Depeche Mode pub.
Wonderful.
In Tijuana.
Well, I'm going to take you from Tijuana back home for track six, Ian. Favourite song from an artist from your home county, please?
Yeah. Oh, it said county. Do you know, I was looking at that and I actually read that as country.
80% of guests do.
Okay. Well, yeah, they're not from my home county then, are they? Yes, because they're from the Isle of Man. I've picked the Bee Gees. I started a joke.
What a record.
It's just one of my favourite singles of all time. One of the albums I got in the 60s, my mum and dad had, they got four albums off the back of a lorry because we were from Hackney and everything was off the back of a lorry or out of a skip. And they got four. I remember coming back with four albums, one of which was the Bee Gees' second album, Horizontal, which isn't on that, actually. This track isn't on that. But I became fairly obsessed with these four albums. So it was like Dusty Springfield, Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, Gorilla, and Timmy Euro, and they were the only four albums. When you've got four albums, you play them.
Yeah.
And when you've got all that lot, you don't play anything hardly because you think, oh, I don't know what to play.
Yeah.
And I got fairly obsessed with the Bee Gees, early Bee Gees, not so much the disco Bee Gees. I mean, Take It or Leave It, they're all right. You know, they've got their place. But I love the melancholy bits of Robin Gibbs' vocals. Mm. And I Started a Joke is just... it's my funeral song.
Yeah.
I would like that played at my funeral. And it's just a wonderful record. And it's just like, and yeah, he wasn't even 20 when he wrote that.
Yeah.
What a miserable bastard. But they just wrote so many brilliant songs. I mean, those first four Bee Gees albums, if you haven't got them, you know, not the Australian one, the first four proper Polydor albums, are just astounding. There's so many brilliant songs on there, and you can see that they're jumping a bit on bandwagons here and there and things like that, you know, going a bit Beatlesy on a few tracks, but when they get down to their ballads and their sort of basic pop songs, they are untouchable as songwriters and vocalists. And I do like a high-pitched voice.
Mm-hmm.
I have got a thing about a falsetto or a high-pitched voice. You know, I like things like at the moment, like the Lemon Twigs.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know them, but their first album's amazing.
Well, you've touched on Sparks quite a lot throughout.
Well, Sparks, obviously, yeah. I mean, there's your falsetto.
Yeah.
And Klaus Nomi, people like that, I really like. You know, so I've got a thing. I mean, I like all sorts of stuff, but I do, and I think that came from the Bee Gees. You know, even My Chemical Romance, you know, the Black Parade album's amazing. And I went to, that's a funny gig. That was a great gig. I remember going to that and never have I heard so many children scream at the same time.
Yeah.
It was like, it scared the shit out of me. Literally, teenagers scared the living shit out of me. It was that. We were like, you know, like, I went to the back with all the mums and dads in the inn. It was like, it was the most amazing cacophony of, like, I've never heard people scream like that when he came out. It was like, whoa.
It is strange when, like, you know, kind of alternative music cut through to that teen audience. An example of that being our mutual friend in Cunton again. We used to go and religiously watch Blur from, like, very early on. You know, we saw them at the Old Trat and all these tiny little shows.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another time about when me and him made up fake press passes from Select magazine and blagged our way into their gig on Clacton Pier.
Fantastic.
But then we saw them on the Great Escape Tour at Wembley Arena. And then all of a sudden,
It was like,
it was their sort of Shea Stadium. It was all these, like, screaming girls. And it was like, oh, right, they're pop stars now. Like,
yeah.
That's what's happened. Like, because we've been standing in these dirty, sweaty pubs watching them, you know, playing, you know, all their stuff. And it, you know, credit to them. They wrote lots of great records that ended up, you know, they couldn't be ignored, them songs. They were so poppy and infectious that they become pop stars.
Yeah, absolutely. It is weird that when it goes from that. I mean, it must really freak bands out. I mean, yeah, My Chemical Romance, you know, obviously started off as just a sort of punk band with big ambitions, and became very pomp and very everything. But then, yeah, when did it go from, like, you know, it being like, you know, skater kids and sort of 20-year-olds to, like, I mean, there were kids that looked like small children.
Yeah.
You know, they were screaming their heads off for you know, a record about death. You know, about death, wearing makeup and dying and cancer and, you know, a miserable bastard record, you know.
Brilliant.
Yeah, really strange. And I haven't been to many gigs like that, so I think that was a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen Kylie and things like that. I've got tickets to Kylie before once, and that was kind of funny, but it wasn't that. But yeah, it's really weird, that thing. It must have been so amazing for bands, you know, and this, you know, you see where Harking Back to the Suite, where they got to a point where they hated it because the Suite always were that rock band that weren't getting taken seriously, mainly because they were wearing ladies' clothes and going on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
But, you know, the B-sides were always, you know, where they'd swear. You know, they'd have a song where they, you know, so your old man wants to call you a degenerate bum or something, you know. And it's like, you know, but the song on the A-side, Fox on the Run, was lovely, you know.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. And you just sort of, you can see them. You can imagine when they did The Rainbow and it was probably full of children.
Mm.
And they're like, this is terrible. So they just want to, you know, Steve Priest would just play up and say the most obscene things just to sort of shock them and try and get them out of there. Quite amazing that, yeah.
Well, for your last song, I guess you get a chance to do what you do best, which is tell us about something that we don't know about and inform us of something great to listen to.
Yeah, there's so many obviously obscure things you could pick from a sort of a collection like this, but I just thought I'd put something that is actually on Damaged Goods that came out this year, and it was just a demo I got. Australian band, four kids, basically all about between 11 and 13, and it's just the most brilliant little pop song. It's called Isabella is Annoying. It's about a girl called Isabella who's annoying them at school, and they've got a really cute video, and it's just a great little pop song. It's sort of their songwriting, and it is them writing it, is astounding for kids that young. And I've never done a record by anyone young like that. It's a one-off single. I don't know if we'll do any more. There's no plans to sort of, like, do anything. And obviously they've had the same problems in Australia we've had. So
sure.
they wanted to be doing a few little gigs and things like that. And they're probably, all their voices are broken now and they've changed completely. But, which is the beauty of bands when they're growing up. You know, one minute they want to do something else, next minute they want to be something else.
Yeah.
But it's just a great little pop song, and everyone that heard it, like Mark Riley at Radio 6, couldn't believe it. He said, "They're really? Are you sure? You're not getting me at it. They're 11 to 13. I was like, yeah, look at the video. Look, they're children, you know, and it's a great little single. So I just thought it'd be quite nice if, you know, give it a bit more of an airing. So yeah, the Rellies, yeah, astounding little 7-inch we did. Only very limited, pretty much sold out. And yeah, we'll see what happens with them. I think one day they'll be kind of famous if they can write songs like that at that age.
So you said, this is just something I want to touch on there, that you said you received the demo. Is that still how it works? I mean, I would find myself strolling around Camden in the 90s with my record bag full of me band's demos, just giving it to anyone that I thought had the right haircut and knew someone at Food Records. It was like, is it still the case that is, you know, get your demo in and let's go from there?
Pretty much, yeah. We still get stuff in the post, but mainly it's emails, and it's getting a bit much sometimes. And the problem is also, sometimes it's better when you're not doing very well or not getting a lot of press, then you don't get so many. But if you have one that gets away, like Hamill and the Sniffers last year, fucking hell, everyone sends you their bloody demo and all sorts of bands. And sometimes they're so uninspired and so, you know, you get rap stuff and death metal from Scandinavia. It's like, have you looked at the label?
Yeah.
Have you seen what we do? You know, you've got to be thinking, you know, aim it at what we do.
Yeah.
Rather than just some random, you know, folky girl with a guitar from, I don't know, wherever. But we still get demos, and it's getting quite hard to actually catch up and actually have the time to listen to everything properly, because you can't. Every day, there's probably been 5 today.
Wow, really?
And a lot of time you can see if it's just the general one that they've sent to everyone on a record label list that they've downloaded from the internet, or it's someone that's actually into the label and targeted. And we can't take on too many more records. We've got enough records really coming out, and I don't want to get any bigger. Don't want to do more. You know, this isn't something I'm trying to take over the world with. We'll carry on at this level. I think it's just, but it's good, you know, every now and again one surprises you, and that was one.
Okay, well, as we start to sort of wrap this up, if people want to sort of find out more about, you know, what's going on with the label, where's the best place for people to keep up to speed on what's happening?
The website's obviously really good, which is damagedgoods.co.uk. And obviously we've got Facebook pages, Twitter, Instagram. That's about it. That's where we basically put all our stuff. We have records coming out pretty much every month. This month we've got Billy Childish album. We just did a Captain Sensible record just before Christmas, Heavenly compilation at Christmas. Coming up this year, we've got a new band to us called the Corettes, whose second album is going to come out on Damaged Goods in September. Would have been earlier, but everyone's waiting till they can hopefully do some gigs again. We've got Billy Childish's son's band, the Shadracks. They were really good. Their second album they've just done. And then we've got some old punk stuff we're throwing out as well. Plus, we're actually having to repress a lot of old records that have run out over the years that now need reissuing ourselves. So we, you know, there's a limited amount of stuff we can actually afford to do at any one time. But yeah, we tend to do a lot of a lot of tweets and Facebook posts, as like a normal label. And you know, much as you know, we get bobbins from it. Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, whatever. You can find all our stuff there if you go to the label, find the label on there, have a scout through. There are some playlists up. And if you sign up for our mailing list or keep an eye on the social media, every week or two we do a little 10, 12 track playlist, which has got something new, something old, and you know, maybe a sweet track on it or something as well. You know, we mix it out. It's not exclusively Damaged Goods. We are bunging, like, you know, Schools Out or something, you know, as well. Just sort of a bit, break it up a little bit. That's probably the best way to sort of find out anything. We've got a mailing list you can sign up for if you want my inane ramblings and Duncan's inane ramblings and moaning about Brexit, the post-Christmas pandemic. Brexit has been great for record labels and small businesses in the UK. Thank God that'll stop all those people in boats coming over. What a stupid idea Brexit is. Absolutely, the worst thing I can imagine in the world is Brexit.
Oh dear!
Don't get me started. We're not political. Not that that's particularly political.
Oh, brilliant! Ian, I'll tag you the label in all of the posts when this comes out on the socials. We'll drop in the web address and that into the bio of this episode, so people can go and get stuck into the website and the back catalogue and go and find out about the huge history of great music that you've put out as a label. I knew this would be a great natter, and and I really appreciate your time. Thanks loads, Ian.
Really good to speak to you. Thanks very much.
Thanks, mate. There you go. What a top lad Ian was. I knew that'd be a great chat. When my pal said you should speak to him, I knew that he wouldn't have done that unless there was... there was an opportunity for a great natter, and that's exactly what happened. I hope you got as much joy listening to that as I did having that. Go and check out the label, click the bio, and the link will be in the bio so you can do that. You can also go over to Spotify and listen to all the songs that that Ian chose over on Spotify. And yeah, as mentioned at the beginning, if you'd like to support the podcast, you can do that on Patreon and get loads of other content. And yeah, go and have a rummage in the back catalogue of this podcast as well. You can do all of it. I'm wittering there. You've had hour and 20 minutes now of chitter chatter, so I'll keep this brief. Everything you need to know about this podcast, www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. There you go. Take care, lovely people. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye. I've got an announcement. Save Our Souls Clothing. www.sosclothing.co.uk. Why am I telling you this? Because they're our official sponsor. Yeah, that's right. Go and check them out because their clothing is off the scale. You're going to love it. So they've decided they want to be our sponsor, which is amazing. And what I have to do is I have to tell you about why they're amazing. So here's a little bit of blurb. So they've only been going a year. And they're based in Southend-on-Sea, just up the road from me. They put the company together based on a love of tattoos and alternative music. And they've worked with some of the greatest artists around the world to produce these items of clothing that are as unique as you lot. All of the designs are printed using biodegradable, sustainable and water-based inks. In addition to that, they only print on garments made by members of Fair Wear Foundation. I mean, come on, great clothing and a conscience. Since going live in April last year, they've seen their audience grow massively and are now selling orders all across the world. And they were recognised by Cosmopolitan magazine as one of the best sustainable clothing brands alongside names such as Stella McCartney. I mean, that's quite a first year, right? So go and check them out because they've put a lot of love into supporting this podcast and I couldn't be happier. What else they've done is they've given you 15% off. So if you head over to www.sosclothing.co.uk, do a bit of shopping, see what you like, throw it in the basket, and then on the way out, put in the discount code BEAT15, BEAT15, and that'll save you 15% off. Amazing, right? www.sosclothing.co.uk, official sponsors of Off The Beaten Track podcast.
It's Off The Beaten Track podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whippin.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.